Welcome to Music A to Z, the podcast. I am Steve Ferguson.
I am Doug Ferguson.
How are you doing, Doug?
I am doing pretty all right.
I suppose I should thank you, being the only brother who actually gave me a birthday present. Thank you for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And included in that birthday present was Daryl Hall's Sacred Songs, which I actually managed to give a listen to.
Oh, you did? Mm-hmm. And how was that?
You know what? It's very enjoyable. Really good.
Because I know, it seemed like the perfect pick, because, like, you really like Peter Gabriel.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of, and Robert Fripp, who... At that point in time, he was between King Crimson and Carnations.
It was one of the things that led to him coming back to the music industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it seemed like, and also you were really getting into Hall & Oates.
Yeah.
At that point in time, so it was just sort of like, yeah, a very logical choice. Kind of Robert Fripp produced the Daryl Hall's first solo album.
I'm so tempted to get into the whole story behind it because it is actually quite fascinating. And the music is quite different from Hall & Oates, but it is very... It's like the first album with Perpetronics on it, interestingly enough.
No, I don't know if that's true.
No, it is true. I'm not even joking.
Okay, maybe there's just, like, earlier versions of it on Hall, the Frippin' Eno's... Ah, well, you know, the thing is, we could do, like, a really extra-long podcast just on Robert Fripp.
It's astounding, yeah, a double episode. But I did want to thank you for that, as I really did enjoy that, and I'm actually going to give a recommendation out there. If anyone can get their hands on Daryl Hall's Sacred Songs, please go and do so. It's actually an excellent, excellent album.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. And so I mean, Daniel, I kind of get not like he's kind of tight for cash.
Yeah.
So I kind of get him not giving you a present.
Yeah.
But what about Mr. I'm rolling in the money bags, Nathan Ferguson?
our sponsor?
yeah. It's like, hey, you get your website and your podcast. That's your birthday present, buddy.
What about Dad? Jeez.
Did Dad go to your party thing?
Yeah.
Oh.
I had a birthday party. It was really good.
I was unable to make it because I had to work. There's a lot of new people at my job, so it's really hard to trade shifts. And
No, you don't have to make excuses. It's fine. I understand full-time work. I get that. There's many things that I've missed out on. But I listened to a bit of that. I had this nice synth rock playlist playing in the background. Our friend Travis came over. I showed him my Sun Rock collection that I bought from in Portland. I bought a collection of Sun Ra
albums. Who you say may be one of the best jazz musicians to have ever lived.
Now, for the record, I know Sun Ra dabbled in a lot of genres. Even within that collection, there was a couple genres he dabbled in. But when he plays jazz, I don't think anyone can play jazz like he plays jazz.
I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, I should have brought it for you.
You didn't. You didn't bring it.
Yeah. Coincidentally, I also bought an album called Direct by Vangelis, and the band that we were covering this week released a song that actually sounds like it could have been straight on that album.
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting. I did not expect to hear that. It is a complete coincidence because we had been talking about doing this guy or this band for a few weeks. And then to listen to the song and be like, holy crap, this is very much like Vangelis.
Who did, like, Blade Runner soundtrack, right?
Yeah, he did the Blade Runner soundtrack. And Chariots of Fire. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
First, for music news. There is something I woke up this morning and I was go through a bit of news and just a bit. Just to get my brain working. And I loved this. Robin Thicke's new album was released on June the 30th. It's called Paula.
Paula. Is that his ex?
Yeah. It's about how sad he is that she's left him.
I shouldn't have made blurred lines. It got me divorced. Oh!
Hey, and you know what? You know what? Frickin' after listening to the song I got, you know, the technical word is sampled from, but I'm going to say downright ripped off by Marvin Gaye. Jeez, I love that Marvin Gaye song. I always look up Blurred Lines Marvin Gaye to find the song on YouTube.
I know what it's called, but just not at this very moment.
That's fine. Marvin Gaye? M is for Marvin Gaye, maybe? Good God, another M.
There's too many M's.
So anyways, Robin Thicke released this new album. It has now been a week at the time of this recording. Guess, now Robin Thicke's Canadian, guess how many albums of Paula has been sold in Canada this past week?
Jeez, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out if it's like been a big hit or a surprising tank.
Just, I'm going to go with the
tank.
In Canada, his home and native land, in a week, it has sold 552 copies.
Oh. Ow. Oh. Oh, everyone's sick of Robin Thicke. That should be the headline of the episode.
The UK, where people like Aaron Carter can get a number one hit. How many copies do you think it sold in the UK?
5,000. 530. Oh, I thought like, oh, well, they're British. They'll oh my god.
They'll give everyone a chance once, and then never again, apparently.
I mean, that's the thing, is that did Robin Thicke, like his album... I don't know if it did well. I just know the single did well.
It did, actually. It did. It sold 13,000 in Canada.
Oh, you mean, okay. I mean, I was talking about Blurred Lines. But
yeah, Blurred Lines. It sold 13,000 in its first week in Canada.
Oh, okay.
Comparable. So, I'm not talking about total. I'm talking about in the first week, Blurred Lines sold 13,000 in Canada.
But I don't know how well his original album did. Like, that's the thing, is that...
Oh, you mean his first album?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to investigate that much into it. I'm only going by the article. The article, by the way, is at CBC Music. I'm not making this up. CBC Music tracks this sort of stuff.
Yeah, we'll put the link in the doobly-doo.
Yeah, sure. Take a look. And in the U.S., it sold 25,000, which, given how much... I mean, it's way better than here, even by numbers and by like, say...
per person?
Yeah, per capita. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But it's still really, really lousy sales.
Well, Robin Thicke, I hope you learned a valuable lesson.
Stop being a huge dick.
Yeah. I get the idea of grieving for the loss of a loved one. Well, even though, like, she didn't die, she just left you. I understand, like, but, you know, you kind of, to quote the famous Radiohead, you did it to yourself. Guess who? And that's what really hurts.
Yeah, I'm nothing against the concept of having an album where, you know, you're working out some emotional issues or whatever.
Yeah,
no. I just think he sucks.
I think the problem is that he publicly became misogynistic,
mm-hmm.
and women don't like that.
Yeah, I think they're willing to go with the beat, like a certain beat, and I don't even want to analyze it too much because the fact that it got that popular boggles my mind anyway.
Yeah,
but no, I say he gets what he deserves. I hope your label drops you.
Sorry, Robin Thicke fans, if you're listening.
All 500 of you.
Okay, for me personally, on some music-ish news, Depp, finally, I got those albums yesterday that he said he was going to send me.
Oh, that's awesome.
Basically, from the Depp episode, I made a brief remark about the fact that he said he'd send me a copy of Ever Looming, and he never did.
It may have gotten sent to my ex's address.
Whatever. But he responded, and I wasn't even like saying it because I'm like, I hope he hears this, and I hope that he.
You just kind of said it off the cuff, really.
I mean, it was just sad. But anyway, he graciously offered to send me that album, and as well as the copy of the newest album. No, it all comes down to this.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I think is really great. It is a departure album, but it's actually really beautiful. So yeah, I got a copy of Ever Looming and that, because he just wanted to throw that in, and he always writes like a little personal note saying like, hey, thanks so much for your support.
Oh, okay.
And I feel like I just think he's a guy who really appreciates the fans that he has. And so Depp, if you're listening to this episode, thank you again. I got them. I really appreciate it. And I'm glad you appreciate us.
I suppose we should get into our episode.
We should get into our episode, eh? So we're on J.
Yep.
Which is a letter after I.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So does that mean we're covering the Jugo Juice Band?
The Jugo, is that a real thing?
No, I just made it up.
I thought so, then we're probably not going to cover it. Let's talk about Jamiroquai.
Oh, yeah.
So, Jamiroquai.
Yeah, they're a bunch of Brits.
Yeah.
A bunch of crazy, crazy British people.
You know, the thing is, you wouldn't necessarily know it by listening to them. Not that yeah. I necessarily know what it means to, like, sound British.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess when I think of British rock, well, I mean, they're not rock. Well, not often, but I guess when I think of British music, I think of, like, a lot of classics, like The Who. The Who are the first, like, British band that come to mind.
Beatles?
Surprisingly, The Who come to mind first. Okay. But, yeah, I mean, The Beatles, that's true. They're pretty British. I mean, they were, like, the on the wave, the forefront of the British invasion.
Yeah. And then Floyd followed it up, and Spice Girls, and Robbie yeah. Williams. And I mean, the British always seem to infiltrate our pop charts, but it's a good thing you mentioned that, because I'm going to quickly talk about Much Music, which is basically like the MTV Canada.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
But not, there is an MTV Canada, but...
But Much Music is more geared toward music videos, where MTV, I think, started with music videos, but it's become, there's a lot more
pop
like
culture.
Pop culture programming,
pop culture, yeah.
Where, yeah, Much Music is still a very music or video-oriented station.
Much Music has also been trying to do music-oriented programming very success, actually, most of the time. Most of the shows that come out with do not do well. I think Video on Trial is still going on, which, to be honest, I think it's just a poor man's
fromage,
where they look at music videos and they lambast them. But they had a show called One Hit Wonders at one point, which I thought was okay. But they included Jamiroquai as a one-hit wonder. Even the host at the time, he says, you know, in fairness, they've had number one hits in other countries. But since they've only had only one number one hit here in Canada, Virtual Insanity, then we're going to include them in this program. That actually legitimately angered me.
Yeah, it's like, we're the only ones who matter.
Well, it's not even that. I mean, you could even have, say, Chumbawamba, who had, like, maybe one or two number one hits in the UK, but everyone knows them for Tub Thumping. I'm okay if you want to call them a one-hit wonder, because that one hit was so massive.
So much bigger than any of their other...
Yeah, even if... And they only ever had a couple other hits that went to number one, maybe, like, number two at most. Jamiroquai is a vast exception to this. Virtual Insanity was number one hits in a string of continual number one hits in Europe, in Asia, basically around the world. They have a hard time tapping the North American audience, but I mean, so what?
Here's the thing, is that like, okay, Virtual Insanity is their most famous song. Fair enough.
But it's their most famous song here in North America.
Well, my understanding is that overall, I mean, I was looking a bit into it, it is the highest charting song, I think, overall across the world. But... I mean, it's not necessarily, like, it's not the only song in the public consciousness.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, yeah, when you talk about, like, New Radicals,
mm-hmm.
you get what you give. Boom.
That's an absolute one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got bands who legitimately were one-hit wonders, who only ever had one hit, and then that was it. Then you've got ones who are kind of questionable, who had, like, a number one hit, and then they had some songs that charted pretty well. But didn't quite hit that. Then you have ones who had, like I said, Chumbawamba, who had like a number one hit that was absolutely massive, so much so that it dwarfed their other number one hits, which they had a few of. But then I don't think, I mean, you can call Jamiroquai a one hit wonder on a technical level, but on a technical level in some markets, I don't know. I was actually really kind of incensed to their inclusion in the show. It just felt wrong.
I mean, maybe they were just looking for a reason to play Virtual Insanity.
Maybe they just were looking for something to fill the time slot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's that too, which is strange, because, I mean, there's been plenty of one-hit wonders. But then again, the problem with that show is that it tended to only really focus on songs released in the last 10 years.
If we are going to call Jamiroquai a one-hit wonder, let's call them one of the most successful one-hit wonder bands ever. Because according to this, Jamiroquai have sold more than 40 million albums worldwide.
And it's not all... one album.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is a collection of albums. Over the years, we have 7 albums.
Yeah, seven studio albums.
Studio albums, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that ain't so bad.
40, yeah, honestly. They have a bloody huge... Well, okay, so does Chumbawamba. But, you know, it's funny I keep mentioning Chumbawamba because they almost kind of come from very similar scenes. You know, they come from... I mean, I realize that there's different sections in the UK and even in the UK in the underground music, like Manchester, and like they'll have different kind of underground music movements. But why I say they're kind of similar is that they were very popular in the underground music scene in the UK. Like, both bands were. But they're just kind of different areas. Jamiroquai was primarily London. Everything that I've seen about the punk movement and stuff doesn't really seem London-oriented. Kind of seemed more like out on the fringe in the suburbs and stuff, not quite in the metropolitan area. But it kind of makes a little more sense to me because Jamiroquai has always incorporated funk and jazz and experimental music, and you know that seems to be less aggressive and more accessible for like the city kids to go and hear at night.
Yeah, true enough. Yeah, it is interesting that like there could be similar roots in a band, and the outcome of what they sound like is radically, radically different.
Yeah, I don't know how much more you could compare the Jamiroquai to Chumbawamba. I mean, then again, I don't know that much about Chumbawamba. I know that.
I will say that's a Todd in the Shadows, who is an absolutely fantastic music reviewer and very, very funny. He did a whole One Hit Wonder retrospective on Chumbawamba, which actually I thought was really good.
Yeah, it was
and
a good episode.
Very, very complete. Yeah, okay, so Chumbawamba came around in Burnley, England, which is a little more, you know, out.
Like, a little more like, we haven't heard of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. And actually, you know, even the Beatles didn't come from London. They came from
Liverpool. Okay. Liverpool.
I'm from Liverpool, and the only thing we're famous for is the Beatles. And I said, well, and Lister from Red Dwarf.
Okay.
It does seem more regular that that bands seem to not come directly from London, but from, say, like the old the towns where workers, you know, would like the working class would be, you know. But in this case, though,
The Who came from London.
Yeah.
There you go.
So. Which, of course, is the first British band. I'm going to quickly mention that I think the first time I heard Jamiroquai was Space, which is a channel here in... It's kind of like Sci-Fi Channel, but a little more credible.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Sci-Fi Channel these days is just...
Sci-Fi, they make a lot of their own shows, yeah. Which I guess is...
It's good and bad. They've got some good shows.
Yeah, but Space does... They play all assortments of sci-fi television from all sorts of places.
When they first launched up, they didn't have too much advertising going on, and they didn't have too much programming. Like they were showing a lot of cheap, shows that you could get on the cheap. But anyways, in between shows, you know, like on the hour or whatever, they would sometimes play music videos that were, say, science fiction related. One of them being Duran Duran's Electric Barbarella.
And there was also one really funny one where there was like really bad looking Daleks, and it was like, Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
Doctor Who.
That's
Doctor.
Right.
I don't know. I don't have any idea who.
By the Time Lords.
Okay. So it is.
Yeah, I remember. They actually got in a lot of legal trouble for that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Something about doing one of Britain's most iconic pop culture BBC-owned entities making a song in a music video and trying to sell it without any permission whatsoever is apparently frowned upon.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to just steal things and then try to make money off of them.
But anyways, one of the music videos that they would play was Emergency on Planet Earth by Jamiroquai, which is the first time I heard of them. Which, I mean, was so catchy, and it incorporated footage from that had been taken from launches, space launches, space orbits and stuff like that.
And then there were, I think Jay, the guy, the lead singer of, I think there was shots of like him chilling in a spaceship and stuff.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, I haven't seen the music video in ages.
It's been a long time. But that was my first exposure to it, and I thought, yeah, this is actually pretty cool. It was kind of a basic song compared to like a lot of their stuff now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's just like, hey, we got an emergency on planet Earth. Hey, like we're burning down the forests.
I think, I can't remember if that was my first exposure to Jamiroquai, or if my first exposure was circa 1999, when Canned Heat was a single on the radio. And I thought, the thing is, when you originally told me about like the One Hit Wonder thing, the first song that came to my mind was like, oh, Canned Heat. Because that was like the song
that big song.
It was, like, that's the thing, it's like, it got radio play. It wasn't a tank of a single.
You had recorded it off the radio, I believe.
I did. Yeah, I used to have like tons of like stacks of cassette tapes of stuff I recorded from the radio.
Yeah, who did?
And Canned Heat was among them. Like, I love Canned Heat. Thing is, like, it was so different than anything else on the radio at the time because it was like a shameless disco dance tune, but it was like good, and so
years later, it suddenly received like a revival when it was included in Napoleon Dynamite.
Why are you so sweaty?
I've been practicing some dance moves.
Yeah,
like, and then true. All of a sudden everybody loved the song again. In fact, there were people who were just like, oh, this song is so awesome.
You know, or there's people saying, it's the Napoleon Dynamite song.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's now forever associated, I think, with Napoleon Dynamite. So it's good that it actually had a lot of radio play years before.
There's another one, another movie was on. I think, like, I want to say Save the Last Dance.
Napoleon Dynamite seems to be, though, like the most popular one.
Center Stage, there we go.
Okay, Center Stage I've never heard of.
Okay, well, I watched it a couple times. I remember the lead actress being extremely attractive.
It's a dance film.
Yeah, but I don't even know any of these names in this movie. Okay, well, in any case, our cousin liked it. It's from the year 2000, the year before Save the Last Dance.
You know Zoe Saldana.
Oh, I apparently know Zoe Saldana. Yeah, okay, well, so she there she is. Now I would not have guessed that she was 36 years old.
Me neither, jeez. Wowzers. Go Gadget. Youthfulness.
Yeah. Okay, anyway.
So,
anyways,
so that was kind of our first exposure to Jamiroquai. They've always just kind of been, the band has always just kind of been in our awareness. Yeah. There was one birthday where I bought you, what, three of their albums?
Yeah, that was Jamiroquai. That was the, I think they were always kind of like on the back burner of what I wanted to listen to, because I think I got, you know, I got Candied off the radio.
Yeah.
And I love the song. And I guess I just never pursued them more. But I think I always expressed interest that, you know, that I liked them.
Yeah.
And then, just, yeah, one birthday, he drops off their first three albums on my lap.
Oh, was it their first three?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, well, I guess I can get all a little bit caught up now. and so I did. And, you know, the thing is, like, I still really enjoy those albums. So thank you.
Sure thing. Let's step back into their history. So they formed in 1992 primarily as a funk and acid jazz band. In fact, their label was the Acid Jazz label, but only for a little bit, actually. So, I mean, they were there together with a bunch of other bands, including Brand New Heavies, who I believe tried to be the frontman of the Brand New Heavies, but they said nah. And so he went and helped form Jamiroquai, which is a mix between jam sessions and Iroquois, which are a Native American tribe. I don't know, like, Iroquois, what the significance is.
I don't know. I mean, could he be partially... Could he be, like, is that his...
But no, his mother is a Brit, a former cabaret singer.
Okay.
And television personality, with Jewish descent.
Okay.
And his dad is a Portuguese guitarist.
Well, then I have no idea.
Yeah.
I guess he just liked the sound of Iroquois.
Well, why not, right?
I mean, it is a... And you know, I actually... This is what I really like about some band names, like Jamiroquai. Mm-hmm. If you, like, Google that you're only going to get information on Jamiroquai.
Yeah.
You know? Like, there's so many band names where it's like a combination of words, and if you Google it, you might find something. But this is a truly unique band name.
Okay, I'm going to mention the music again. There's a band, was a band called The Music.
Yes.
It was the most frustrating thing on the planet to try to look for information of them online. It was so infuriating to try to go to Google and type in The Music, then go into Google, type in The Music Band, then go into Google and type in The Music Discography. Like, you either have to know the names of their albums or the individual band member names. I like The Music. I like The Bands. I really do.
There was an episode. I used to listen to CD Baby Music Discovery podcast.
Yeah.
There was one episode where they, it was called The Ungoogleables.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
And it was basically, the feature playlist was bands that if you tried to Google them, yeah, good luck. And
there's the Who on there?
No. It's an independent artist.
Oh, okay. And, yeah, of course.
So, but I remember the funniest one to me was a band just called I.
Oh, no.
Oh, and another one was called Instruments.
Instruments? Like, I get where you're going from an artistic, because, I mean, you make a lot of interesting artistic statements with calling yourself Instruments, but...
Because, like, I mean, that's the thing, is that if you type in Instruments, you're like, oh, no, okay, let me specify it. Instruments, band. Oh, no! it doesn't work.
I'm going to look that one up, because that sounds hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, it was years ago, like, it was from circa, like, 2009, but I think they have them all archived, so...
JK is the vocalist. Toby Smith was the keyboarder. Stuart Zender was the bassist. Nick Van Gelder was on drums. Wallace Buchanan was on the didgeridoo. Yes, that's right, folks. The didgeridoo, that Australian instrument that makes the...
Wow, 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 was that...
Yeah, and Alec Morin typo, which I can only assume... You okay?
It's hard to do that didgeridoo sound.
Alec Morin typo, which I can assume is something you smoke. Yes. It is worth knowing that only out of this original lineup, only JK is still with the band at this point.
Just to confirm, it's J-A-Y-K-A-Y.
Yes.
That's how he... That's
JK!
No. Hello, wild guy.
However, they had their percussionist, Sola Akinbola. That's a cool name. And drummer, Derek McKenzie.
They've been around
since 94. So, only a couple years into the formation, but anyway. They have a lot of former members.
Toby Smith was a very key member for quite a few of the years, and he left in 2002, but he was one of the head songwriters of the bunch, too. So.
I will note as well that even though I love the inclusion of a didgeridoo in the band, by the time they got to Traveling Without Moving, it sounded like that they were trying to find ways of give him things to do in the band. It's like, oh, shoot, we've just recorded, six songs and haven't used them at all.
He's in the other room, he's like, hey, guys.
Hey, guys, when are you going to need me?
I'm not just redo here.
They're like, oh. So, I mean, they didn't keep him, he's just not there still, but.
He left 1999, so I guess that's either right before, I guess it was around the Synchronized, the Canned Heat era.
No, I'm not going to put down the digital, because in the songs that it isn't, I think it sounds great and has a fantastic, distinct personality, but I can understand how it would be limiting and difficult to continue to write songs. Yeah.
They've gone through a lot of members.
They have.
Actually, they have a lot of current members. So, right now we have JK, Derek McKenzie,
Sola Akinbola.
Rob Harris, Matt Johnson, Paul Turner, James Russell, Jim Corey, Malcolm Strachan, and Tony Tango Threlfall.
But for him, why does it say 92 to 94?
Hey, yeah, why does it say current members?
Well, it's his Fractal Designs. I don't even know what that means. So.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's interesting to note, though, we've got saxophones, flutes, trumpets, and such like that.
The kind of music they make is very varied in tone, very almost down to earth in it's got synthesizer, but there's a lot of traditional instrumentation in there.
Mm-hmm.
So they play around with the old ideas and the new ideas, mix them up, turn them into a disco-y, funky jumble.
They released their first single, "When You Gonna Learn," back out in 92 on Acid Jazz, the label. It met with some actually really, really fantastic reception.
What was it? Was it just a single?
This was a single, and then it was re-released as a single off of their first upcoming album. That was the thing, is that their first single that came out when it came out on the Acid Jazz label, I mean, everybody was loving it. It was going out and becoming exceptionally popular. So Sony snapped them up, said, okay, let's get an H record deal going with you guys. Somehow that didn't exactly pan out.
Mm.
And then they re-released a single under Sony as well. It's worth noting that from the get-go, Jamiroquai has had a very, very strong environmental message behind it. It's like, why we got to be killing the earth? When are you going to learn that killing the earth is awful?
It's not a good idea, guys, because I live there.
Yeah.
Hence, Emergency on Planet Earth. It's not just a catchy title. It's a song with a lot of intent. And it's fun to listen to,
mm-hmm.
but it's also like, hey, we're killing the planet Earth, guys. We need it still, so let's not do that.
Now it is interesting that Sony did pick them up, because when I say that the album was successful, it was successful critically and in their circles, but on the whole, commercially, it didn't fare too well. But everyone who heard it loved it, so nobody was really scooping it up too much. But I mean, I guess it was getting a lot of significant PR from people in the industry. And plus, they have such a unique sound. So I mean, kudos to Sony to grab it. Although I mean, I don't know if Jamiroquai is still happy with Sony at all, because they haven't been on Sony for a while.
I mean, I don't know. What label are they on at the moment?
I was looking it up because they had switched to one, and then they recently switched to another.
The thing is about record labels, and this is the thing I don't like about record labels, is that...
They're on Universal. They went to Columbia, and then they ditched Columbia, and they've gone to Universal.
What I don't like is that the contracts are... I mean, they basically... They lock the artist into the label, but at any point in time, the label can just drop the artist.
Yes.
I think that defeats the purpose of the contract, in that... It's just a means of a label controlling you rather than having something that's more mutually beneficial. The thing is that the label should have just as much commitment to the band and seeing the band have success.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it's like if the band starts to lose the success that they once had, then, the label's just like, you're no longer any use to us, and therefore you won't have access to the kind of things that happen with our label, so shoot, off you go, have fun. It's a dangerous world out there.
Yeah.
It's just dangerous to go alone, take this.
Do you remember that Cracked article I sent you by the rapper who did this on I'm Awesome?
Spose,
yeah, and his experience with record labels? I'm Awesome was this really catchy, fantastic little rap song about an overblown ego when one shouldn't be having an overblown ego. And he was scooped up by a record label, and they were going through the process of making an album together, and he describes it in this article as such the most surreal thing, because he'd come in, and there'd be, like, 8 writers at a table, and they're like, okay, we're going to write your new song. And he's like, well, I kind of write my songs. And then they start writing these stereotypical rap songs. He says, well, that's not really the type of music I make. And he went through the process, and then the label's like, actually, that's what I thought. Nah, forget it. And then they just drop him. The end. He's fine with it because now he gets to release all his music himself and the way he wants to. But it's such a surreal experience.
The truth is, I feel like this day and age, for a lot of artists, it's tough because there's so many independent artists out there.
Yeah.
But I think that if you really just kind of want to make the music you want to make, you just should probably stick to being independent because there's ways you can get your music out there.
These days, yeah. It's
but then again, like Jamiroquai, this was back in like 1992, 1993.
Yeah.
When the internet was something that some people had and it was really slow and people didn't really know how to use it or what it was for.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when we first had the internet, I didn't get it. I'm like, I don't see this catching on. Because I just didn't get it. I didn't understand what the point was of it. But I was a kid, and I think mom and dad didn't really get it either. So
what were they supposed to show us? There were chat rooms.
And chat rooms. I couldn't even type.
Those online D&D sort of RPG games.
And one of the first things I remember using the internet for was this online game where you you saw a face. And then it scattered apart, and you had to take the pieces of it like a puzzle and try and reconstruct it or something like that.
Why do you need the internet to play that game?
You don't. But that was just, I was a game that mom played, and she's like, you want to try? And I remember trying it and being okay at it. I don't know. That's just one of my weird, strange, distant memories of my first internet exposure. And again, I didn't get it.
Yeah. So, at the time then.
To get your music out there, you need to have a record label. Yeah. You were either a local band who played gigs and got a little bit of buzz, or you'd be picked up by a label and have the potential to go international.
Yeah.
So,
and all in all, I think it worked out ultimately to Jamiroquai's benefit. I don't know. I don't know anything about how their financial thing, because I know that they're who was it? TLC would sell millions and millions of records and be flat broke because they were being screwed by their label. There's so many stories about bands being screwed by their labels.
Block Party.
Yeah.
Block Party had to, there was a situation where the label, prepaid for studio sessions and then they just wound up being in debt with their label. Even though, they sold a lot of albums, they couldn't compete with, how much money they were sinking into paying back the record labels. That's why their fourth album, they switched to Arts and Crafts.
Mm. And, good move.
Yeah, and because Arts and Crafts seems like the kind of label that's interested in maintaining artistic merit and quality and isn't so much about just making money off the music. Not that they don't want to make money.
Yes.
You want to make money, if you want to keep doing what you're doing. But
they don't want to screw each other over. Especially because it's a label started by musicians.
Yeah.
So.
So, yeah, so I can't speak as to the relationship. I mean, they can't be 100% against big labels because now they're on their third major label. Like I said, they went to Columbia, and now they're at Universal. But mind you, they probably have enough clout to dictate a lot of terms.
Now, that's because at this point, like, they're well known. Like, you can guarantee that a Jamiroquai album will sell. It won't necessarily go, like, platinum anymore, but it will sell.
It'll sell worldwide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Jamiroquai.
They're a safe bet.
It's a good, yeah.
Exactly. It's not high stakes, but they're a really safe bet.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that first album, Emergency on Planet Earth, released by Sony back in 1993. I haven't heard too much of it.
Really?
Yeah.
So I've had it for years.
I've heard it, but...
Okay, yeah, but I guess, I mean, that's the thing, is because you dropped, like, three albums on my lap.
Yeah.
I probably listened to them all, then dropped the three on your lap, and then when you have that much to listen to... It all kind of blends together. I know it kind of did with me at first.
No, well, I do know it got very good reviews, but tell me about Emergency on Planet Earth. Like, how do you feel about it?
It feels like a debut album in that it's very, like, okay, raw almost seems like the wrong word, but there is something very raw about it. And it's not so much like it's not like shoddily produced or anything. It's not as polished as their later stuff. But it's still very, like, slick sounding.
Yeah.
But I think there's this sort of raw energy and creativity behind it that I quite enjoy. It also comes down to like it's interesting. There is sort of a punk-ish vibe to them.
Oh.
But it's not musically, sort of attitude-wise. It's particularly in like Revolution 1993. Emergency on Planet Earth, like there's If I Like It, I Do It,
mm-hmm.
like that kind of like, just be yourself, do what you want to do, follow your own dreams, like that kind of like, nonconformity, plus save the earth kind of messages behind it, like it is an album, it's got attitude,
okay,
yeah, but at the same time. It's like a dance album at the same. So it's a very curious release, and I kind of see I definitely see why the labels saw a lot of potential in these guys, and I can see why. But at the same time, I can also see why, because this was like, I don't know, 1993. What kind of stuff was coming out in 1993? I'm thinking
Zooropa. Zooropa actually won the Grammy for Best Alternative Album that year.
It was still like grunge era, eh?
Yeah, but it was starting to move. Well,
there was a huge
rap and hip hop were becoming more
rap and hip hop plus like alternative rock.
That's right. REM. When did Losing My Religion come out? Oh, when did Out of Time?
Out of Time. I'm gonna say I think it was early '90s.
Yeah, was it 94?
91.
Oh Jesus, earlier than I thought.
Okay, yeah. So
hold on then. So REM is like basically the height of their popularity at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, true. So
not that they lost a lot of popularity.
But I'm also thinking really things paid. Like Soul Asylum.
Oh, Soul Asylum. Yeah.
Okay, that was 1995.
Well, there's still only a couple.
So yeah, like but around that era.
So actually you got a few different things happening in the music scene at this point.
Yeah, so like hip hop's coming into play.
Like in a huge way. It's emerging from the underground where it's just like parents are like, "What are you listening to?" And becoming getting more play on mainstream pop radio at this point.
Yeah, but there was nothing that was like Jamiroquai, which is total like funk, jazz, disco hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Okay, I've been calling them Jamiroquai. You call them Jamiroquai. Which do you think's right?
Jeez, you know, I don't know. I feel like, oh, look at that. This album is, Emergency on Planet Earth is in the list of 1,001 albums you must hear before you die.
I like how Doug scratched that issue. He's like,
I'm sorry.
Oh, look at this.
I keep seeing that list appear.
By Entertainment Weekly? No, it's not Entertainment Weekly. No.
Well, anyway, but yeah, Jamiroquai. I say Jamiroquai. You say Jamiroquai.
I think it's because I see Iroquois, right? But mind you, they've misspelled, or not misspelled, they've spelled the Iroquois portion differently, maybe.
Anyways. Hey, everybody. If you think that I'm completely wrong by saying Jamiroquai, feel free to write in and tell me I'm an idiot. And if you think Steve's wrong by saying Jamiroquois,
it does happen,
then you should write in and tell him he's an idiot. Or we can talk about it peacefully.
So it went, this album went platinum in Japan, in France.
And the UK.
Yeah, in the UK. So, hey, I mean, this is a very, very good charting. It appears the definition of platinum is different.
And it was it was number one UK albums chart.
Yeah, it's actually, and you look, it's, you know, it's all over the world. Sweden, New Zealand, Australia, Germany,
so,
France, the Netherlands.
We could say
Australia.
That they were off to a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. Critically well received, commercially sold very, very well. So
but if you see, there's no blip in North America.
No. But you know what? I mean, I wouldn't complain with this sort of. I wouldn't be like.
Yeah, I mean, if that happened with my band, I'd be like, wow, we're doing well.
Now this would probably help explain why the next album, Return of the Space Cowboy, was released October of 94 in the UK, and then 7 months later, May 95 in the US. I think it sounds to me like they were really kind of hesitant to release it in the US.
I mean, I don't know how much money it cost, actually. I mean, especially since at that point, I mean, I don't know how much it would cost to, like, release an album.
Well, bear in mind, though, you had way more CD stores, though, right? So
yeah.
You want to ship to all these stores. Whereas nowadays, I mean, Jesus, you can probably count them on one hand how many are in the Vancouver area.
CD stores?
Yeah. Stores that sell CDs. Like primarily music stores, you know? I mean, because you got, like, Future Shop and stuff that have a CD section. But, I mean, like, stores that are, like, here's a music store.
And even, like, the places that sell CDs, they're... I mean, their CD section is, like, diminishing. Like, Zulu Records in Vancouver, their CD section is, like, they scale it back for vinyl, interestingly enough. It's interesting.
So, anyways, Return of the Space Cowboy, their second album.
This is the return of the Space Cowboy. I will let you know
that, once again, it charted very well. Platinum France, Platinum Japan, Platinum UK, Gold Switzerland. Et cetera, but, and charted across the world again, except in North America. I'm not seeing much charting going on in North America.
Nope, not in that. And, you know, this is the thing about, like, I feel we kind of get gypped because we're so inundated with what America finds popular. Like, we don't really, it's hard for something to, like, kind of make it in Canada and not have that American influence. I think, like, occasionally we have local bands or Canadian bands that chart here and don't chart over there. But for the most part, like, if something overseas doesn't chart in the U.S., we don't get exposure to it, so it can't really chart in Canada.
So tell me about Return to the Space Cowboy, Doug. How was it?
It is a very logical follow-up, I think. It's not a dramatic improvement. It's not a downgrade. So it doesn't suffer from, like, the sophomore album syndrome where it's, like, it just isn't nearly as good. So it was released like a year later and maintained a pretty good quality. But yeah, I don't know if there's too much more to talk about, because again, it was sort of like it was consistently good. Hmm. Yeah. I think that there might be a few more songs that are really memorable from the first album. There's some really good stuff on here. Actually, Light Years is one I really, really like. Yeah. But I think that with their next album, Traveling Without Moving, I think that's where they really stepped it up a notch.
Just before Traveling Without Moving, in Japan, they released something called Jay's Selection, where Jamiroquai played, basically, it's a cover album. They played a bunch of songs that, you know, influenced them. Sly, Family Stone, Earth, Wind, and Fire, which makes a lot of sense. Isley Brothers, Herbie Hancock, which makes a lot of sense. He didn't. JK didn't sing on any of them, but kind of mixed them all together, played them up stuff, but released only in Japan. I'm kind of curious to hear that. Traveling Without Moving is one that I have, and JK at this point became kind of fascinated with sports cars. To the effect that some of the most hardcore fans are saying, oh, look at them, Jamiroquai is giving up on their environmental message, and now they're just obsessed with cars. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. I don't think... Like, I like to consider myself an environmentalist, and I also think Ferraris look really kind of cool. Whenever I see a Lotus on the road, I get excited.
I'm pretty indifferent toward cars in general, but I will say, I mean, then again, when they look shiny, they look shiny.
Mm-hmm.
I think that getting a sports car doesn't necessarily mean that you're being irresponsible as an environmentalist. I think, I mean, hey, at least they don't have like a private jet they're zooming around in. You know?
That we know of. I don't think they have a private jet.
I don't
think so. But the big single off this was Virtual Insanity.
It's a good video, and I think that's one of the reasons why the single did as well as it did, cause especially like with MTV. That's probably why they did as well as it did in the U.S., because MTV probably picked it up because it was a very visually interesting music video, and the song happened to be really good as well.
I will say, though, that I actually think the album version isn't as superior as the single version. The album version has this sudden music interlude where things slow down a bit. And it slows it down. I actually think it takes away from the energy of the song.
I would actually agree with you. I don't dislike it, but I think that, you know, it definitely isn't as focused.
And that is one of the very rare occasions where I'll say that the single version is better.
But then again, like, it's not even like a dramatic difference.
No.
It's just a slight preference. I would say anyway. The video was directed by Jonathan Glazer.
Yeah.
Who directed a few Radiohead videos as well as a few feature films, mm-hmm. most recently Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson.
Oh yeah, okay.
So, and I haven't seen Birth or Sexy Beast, but
He also did Cosmic Girl as well, so he was kind of working with them. Karma Police and Street Spirit, which is one of Radiohead's best videos with one of Radiohead's best songs. That actually makes a lot of sense. If you watch the Street Spirit video, what a stylistic and visually interesting video.
Also directed at Universal by Blur. Mm. And
Massive Attack. This guy's got a really good, really good
collection.
Collection of works, yeah.
Yeah. And he does a lot of commercials. He's a pretty accomplished director, I'd say.
Good.
I
will mention that the song that I was talking about, the one that sounds like something done by Vangelis, was on this album. It's Digital Vibrations. It's not digital. It's Digital.
Like Didgeridoo mixed with digital.
Digital Vibrations. It's suddenly we have... It sounds so much like Vangelis. Like crazy, crazy, crazy amount. Which is interesting. It isn't quite what you'd expect, but it does... Like if you listen to the album, you will hear that it... It sounds, I kind of want to say, old, you know, like the synth is it has an older style of synth that you don't really hear in music a lot these days, because it's almost a little too corny, too cheesy to use.
I know what to hear the song.
Yeah. Give it a listen, you'll hear what I'm saying.
But yeah, I can't think of how it goes off the top of my head.
It is an odd choice to use.
Even though I just listened to this album like a couple days ago.
This is, though, the point where I was saying that it looks like they were having a hard time figuring out what to do for Wallace, the didgeridoo player, because they have now two tracks in a row where they use the didgeridoo, but not really the rest of the album. They're like, oh, yeah, here, play something. There you go. Okay, good, here he goes. And it's good. It's good. Don't get me wrong there. I think the didgeridoo sounds good and brings a great sound to the album, but most of the songs, you don't hear it, and I won't necessarily say that, oh, it should have been in here. Where should have been Didgeridoo and Cosmic Girl, or Use the Force. Use the Force, which, by the way, is every time I hear that song, all I can think of is Star Wars.
Well,
it's like, what were you... Come on, guys!
I mean, it says right here, Use the Force contains references to Star Wars. It's intentional. It is definitely...
It's almost like, distracting.
Fair enough. So I would say that Traveling Without Moving is one of their best albums. I think it really hits out of the park for me. Although, yeah, a couple years later, Synchronized came out. Actually, you know, I can't pick a best album by Jimmy Rickwell. I don't know what I'm talking about. every time I look at some of the track lists, I'm like, oh, yeah, those are all great songs. Yeah, because Synchronized, I really enjoyed this one, too. It opens with Canned Heat. I have such a soft spot for that song. Mm. It's one of those cases, though, where because I listened to it so, like, separately from... like the rest of their output.
Yeah.
It's this almost disassociated with Jamiroquai. It's almost like here's Jamiroquai A, here's Jamiroquai B. And so like listening to it in context of with their other songs, so they're like, oh yeah, that's right. Canned Heat is one of them.
They're still releasing albums at a really good clip though. I mean this is only 3 years later and this is the longest gap
releasing albums in
3 years.
Yeah, that's true. Like, through the 90s, like, between 93 and 99, that's
That's four albums. That's pretty good, you know?
Yeah. So for those of you who are following along at home and are checking out the albums as well, you'll probably notice that there's a recurring cover art theme.
Yeah, there's this, what's it called?
The Buffalo Man.
Buffalo Man, yeah.
JK had gone on record saying that he was fascinated with the story of Theseus and the Minotaur.
Okay.
And it almost seems like a merging between Theseus, this reluctant hero, and the Minotaur itself. Kind of like a blend, kind of like a merging. That's the impression I get when I look at it. Because, you know, he's just kind of chilling out. But he's got these big, massive horns. And, yeah, for whatever reason, they went with it.
But the thing is, like, I dig it. You know, like it's sort of this look that unifies their albums. Like you spot the Buffalo Man, aha, it's a Jamiroquai album. You don't even need to see their name or their font or whatever it is. You see the Buffalo Man, and there's something about him, like the design of him, that just kind of matches their music.
Mm-hmm.
So it's whoever designed the Buffalo Man, great job. It really works. It works for Jamiroquai.
So for Synchronized, this is like apparently the last album featuring a good portion of the members.
Yeah.
And there's a sound change from this point on. And interestingly enough, this album was released in the US before the UK.
Okay.
I wonder about that. My first thought would be, you know, the last album did so well in the US, finally. Maybe they were saying, okay, well, we got to get something. They've been waiting long enough. We don't want the American audience to forget about them. Let's get it out as quick as we can. Or perhaps even, we want to release in the U.S. first so that the American audience won't just...
Maybe it was just that they were finally so grateful that Jamiroquai made it in the States now. Like, oh, yes, here you go, guys, you get the album early.
Now,
and who knows?
Ironically, though, it did not achieve any certification in the U.S. It did in Canada. We did give it a gold certification.
All right, well, there you go.
It went 4 times platinum in Japan.
Japanese love Jamiroquai, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, though. Like, wow. It really sold in Japan.
Jamiroquai! We love you! Excuse me. Sorry, I might be being a little racially insensitive.
Yeah, I'm just going through. It actually charted in a lot of countries, a lot more countries, like Norway. It went to 28 in the U.S. Billboard, but that's small compared to everyone else I'm looking at. Like, Austria went to number 2. Belgium, it went to number 4. Yeah, it's almost too bad. So it did chart in the U.S., but not fantastically. I mean,
you know, it's kind of weird. Like, maybe like the mainstream public, apart from the Japanese, of course.
Yeah.
Kind of like the novelty of what Jamiroquai was, but couldn't like attach to them full time. You know.
Interestingly enough,
but then again, I mean, not that Jamiroquai is like music from the fringes, but I guess there's a line between being popular and being like mainstream popular, and the fact that they managed to breach that even like in 1996, I think was pretty impressive.
I think the sound had kind of moved though away, because this is the year that Californication came out.
And yeah, 1999. But, I mean, if you think about 1999, yeah, there's Red Hot Chili Peppers, Backstreet Boys,
Surrender, Surrender by Chemical Brothers.
Yeah. But there was a sort of a shift in music. I keep thinking like there was a big pop jump, like
all the boy bands,
Britney Spears and Jennifer Lopez,
Christina Aguilera.
Yeah, like there was a big pop push.
So it might have been just that it didn't chart so well because there was oversaturation of the market.
Well, and just people were starting to listen to crappier music.
I won't even say that though. I think there was a lot of good albums released in 99, and I think it kind of split the audience in that you had the people who were pop chart devotees going their ways, and the people more interested in music had music as an art had a lot of things to look at too.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
A lot of competition.
I guess I was thinking like, I mean, that's the thing is that it, like I said, they kind of struck gold traveling without moving, and it's a hard thing to reproduce when you're a band with a certain identity that goes against the grain of what it is that a lot of people are listening to.
But at the same time, I almost don't want to give that excuse, because again, 4 times platinum in Japan. In Japan, it's not like Japan doesn't have a huge pop music movement, you know?
No, that's true.
Like they have a huge market for pop music, but Jamiroquai still came in and crushed all that.
True enough. So it's, I don't know what it is about
maybe
their...
Maybe you can't predict it sometimes, you know?
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I find that the music industry is a treacherous field.
It's fickle.
People can turn on you.
Yeah.
On a dime. A couple years later, they release a Funk Odyssey. And my main complaint with the Funk Odyssey is that the Buffalo Man is not on the cover.
Staring at the cover art too long may give you a headache. Maybe that was it. Maybe they retired the Buffalo Man because
maybe it was because
they didn't retire him. He shows up again later.
But maybe they thought at the time that because they lost so many members and there was a big shift, and that it was just time to like do something different. I was just gonna say that I haven't listened to some, so I can't really comment too much on Funk Odyssey because it is the one album I haven't heard by them, and it's not that I don't want to, it's just that I haven't yet.
It charted really well everywhere except it charted 44 out of the top 200 in the U.S. Now, if you're listening, why does Steve keep bringing up the charts? It's because with Jamiroquai in particular, I find it utterly mystifying.
Yeah. Because,
like, this is a case legitimately where they will chart amazing everywhere, but not really the U.S. Now, I think one of the huge hindrances to this album is, did you see the exact release date?
No, I didn't.
The U.S., September 11th, 2001.
No way. Yeah. They had the September 11th spot.
They had a September 11th release.
Right beside Mercury Rev's All His Dream. That is unfortunate.
It's the day of the week when new albums get released. So there were albums that came out that day. Whenever there's a tragedy that happens, there are some albums that, like big national scale tragedy. There are some albums that actually do really, really well because people kind of take it up as like an anthem and they find it encouraging and stuff.
Well, I mean that could do it. Now,
it was released a week earlier in the UK though. So at least they had a buffer, I guess.
At this point, Jamiroquai significantly slowed down their output. And I guess it's understandable. Like, when your band reaches, like, almost 10 years old, you don't want to, like, start sounding the same all the time. And I think this is when Toby Smith, one of the chief songwriters, left. So, yeah, there wasn't nearly as much content. So
reviews were a little more mixed of this one.
Dynamite.
Yeah. Funk Odyssey.
Funk Odyssey. Okay.
Yeah, so we're moving on to Dynamite, which I believe has two cover arts. One of them has Buffalo Man on it.
I like the Buffalo Man one better actually. So that's what I have on my iPod.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is you know what? Actually, this is the one I enjoy a lot though.
It's a little more stripped down.
Yeah,
I find it to be it's got some more. It's got piano for starters.
It kind of defuncts itself a little bit. Yeah. So it explores a lot of other genres, such as like I feel like there's a lot more rock elements in this one.
Yeah,
which is kind of cool to hear like different sounds being incorporated into the overall Jamiroquai. Well, I don't know what to call it.
Whatever.
The overall like vision of the band. It's kind of so yeah. There's a lot in here that if you were not sold on like their disco-y, funky stuff. Mm-hmm. This one has stuff to offer that you wouldn't hear on their other albums.
I actually like this album quite a bit, but it did chart well in the UK, but it slipped in a lot of markets. In the US, it plunged, but it you could see some slipping. Where markets that really liked it beforehand, like Sweden or Belgium, it took a bit of.
But wait, where are the Japanese on the? Oh, eight.
Eight.
So, yes.
Oh yeah, I mean, eight. It's still pretty good. It's still but it went from triple platinum the last album to gold. So yeah. I don't know what goes on in the Japanese music market. Maybe something else came out that they absolutely loved. I don't know.
The thing is, maybe it's a mix of like the fact that they were gone for so long. There was a 4-year gap instead of like the normal like
two or three
years. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it is that makes people want to listen to the next album. I don't hear or see a lot of album advertisements unless it's like a really big act.
Yeah.
I don't know what maintains an interest in markets. I know what's...
At this point, though, we have the internet in full swing in an incarnation that we basically recognize as today.
Yeah, there's a lot of sites and stuff that are coming. Like at this point, but 2005, YouTube was a thing, or Facebook just was starting. Facebook wasn't quite mainstream yet,
but
MySpace was definitely happening by this point.
So, I mean, at this point, we can't even necessarily say, oh, well, you know, they don't have the means to publicize. I don't know what happened with this. I like this album. I think it's a good album.
I definitely say Dynamite's worth listening to. I own it, and I quite like it. So check out Dynamite if you. It is a little bit of a different flavor for Jim Iroquois, but I think that it's not a shocking departure. It's good. I think at some points it's even a little more. It's a little less jammy and a little more songwriting oriented, which is good.
Right on the heels of that, they had a compilation released, which was the end of their eighth album deal with Sony.
High Times, right?
Yeah, and they managed to leave Sony, and they said, "See ya, toodles," and hopped on board to Columbia.
I'll just say High Times. There are a couple songs on there that are not on any albums, and I picked them up on iTunes. You can buy them as separate tracks, and I'd say they're worth listening to. I'm drawing a blank of what they're called.
We're having some serious memory issues
today. I actually felt like I prepared for this one too. Like I was just doing a lot of like reading and listening.
Pretty,
Runaway and Radio. Yeah, they're good. I mean, I don't know what else to say about them. They're not particularly like mind blowing Chimeroquad tracks, but they're good. So if you're a fan, you should download those two because they're only on that release.
They went to Columbia Records, but I don't know what exactly happened because I'm a little confused because then they went to Universal. So I don't know what exactly happened there. I'm actually legitimately confused. If anyone wants to write in and explain this whole thing, because from what I can see, it doesn't look like they released anything with Columbia, really.
So they went to their label and they're like, "Hey, this is a cool studio you guys have."
Unless maybe it's sort of like both.
Yeah.
Like both Columbia and Universal, because I do know that sometimes that happens where there'll be one label in one market and a different label in another market. Although, I mean, I guess if you don't want to keep all your birds in one basket,
birds?
I don't know. If you don't want to, like, have all your chips in one pot.
Yeah, okay.
Whatever. I do know that Rock Dust Light Star.
Yeah, that's, 5 years later. Like I said, they really slowed down their output, but oh, there's an alternative color with the Buffalo Man.
Yeah.
So the covers seem to either be the Buffalo Man or Jay wearing a funny hat. A very specific funny hat with, like, metal feathers on stuff on it.
Rock Dust Light Star incorporates a lot more disco.
Yeah?
Yeah. I get a lot of disco off the album. You know what? Got pretty good reviews all in all. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, people were kind of appreciative, I guess.
I like it. I feel like it's not one of my favorite ones of theirs, but at the same time, it didn't feel like a disappointment to me. It was definitely polished.
Yeah.
Like, it is a much more polished album than a lot of their other ones.
It did not chart in the U.S. at all. U.K. did okay, but it's actually a little mixed. Some markets, like the Netherlands, really dig it.
German likes it.
Yeah, Germany likes it, but, I mean, others, though. It's really pretty far down. But I will say, though, if you take a look, it is included in more markets than now. I don't know. It hit platinum in Italy, but and gold in the UK. Gold in Russia. All right. Well, there you go.
Focusing too much on, like, where I wanted to chart. I know that.
I'm just so fascinated by this because, it honestly, Jamiroquai is a worldwide. So they're a band that appeals to different countries on so many levels. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. I just find this so amazingly fascinating.
I mean, that's the thing, is that it is weird. Like, they're so inconsistent.
From country to country. From country to country. But there's a worldwide appeal to them.
But at the same time, like, it's not like they've radically changed at any point musically. Like, yeah. they've explored a lot of genres, but they've always maintained their sound and their style and their unique identity.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, I've never listened to anything and I'm like, whoa, this is Jamiroquai?
Yeah.
What's going on?
It's just like, it kind of seems like the world at some points wants Jamiroquai, and other times, I don't know. Well, anyways, what is your impression of, because I've listened to this quite a bit lately. It's one of the albums that I know about. What do you think of him?
Of Rock Dust
Lightstar.
I think I said I like it, and I think that, you know, it doesn't disappoint, but it's also, I'd say that Dynamite was a hit home a little more for me.
They seem to replace basically, upon listening to some, most of the jazz elements with disco, which I'm fine with that for the time being. I don't know if I necessarily want to see all their albums have that from this point on, as I miss some of the jazz elements. But by the same token, I mean, if the next album, I'm hoping there's a next album,
Yeah, like apparently there's one planned for later this year or early 2015.
Well, there you go, 4 or 5 year gap. I'm curious to see if this disco thing is just like a sidestep or if this is a more evolution of their sound. But on the whole, I think the album is pretty good.
Yeah,
I have absolutely no qualms. I think you gave me this album, actually.
I don't think I did.
No?
No.
I don't know if I bought it.
I think you bought it from the store in Bellingham.
Or you might be right.
Yeah.
You might be right.
I don't know. I have a memory for these kind of things. I know exactly what albums I got at people. And I also know what albums people got me.
Okay.
Yes. I just archived this information in my head. it's kind of weird.
All right. I have not seen any of their live stuff. Have you?
No, I have. Yeah, unfortunately, I want to see more live shows, especially now that we're doing the podcast, because I think that seeing the live shows of bands, it adds a new perspective on them and what they have to offer. But unfortunately, I've never heard of Jamiroquai coming to town.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they've come to Vancouver, but I don't even remember hearing about it at any point. But I wouldn't mind seeing them. Like, it seems like I can't imagine it not being a really energetic show. And really, really fun. Like, I think that it would be good to watch. In fact, I kind of want to go to YouTube and watch some videos. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know though. I feel like I guess this is a bit of a bias. I feel like it would be a big deal if they came to town and then we would know. Alas, do some track recommendations.
Absolutely.
First from Dynamite. I love 7 Days in Sunny June. Sorry. I actually really, really dig that song. It goes through some movements, right?
I was eyeing just because that was one I was going to pick.
I know.
Not that because I'm like, you like that one. But no, I agree 100%. 7 Days in Sunny June is I think that's one of their best written songs.
Like, it goes through some movements. There's the piano, there's guitar. It's got that cool, funky...
It's smooth, it's beautiful, yeah. It's like, it's soothing, it's heartbreaking, it's emotional. I totally agree. I gives my thumbs up as well. Continue.
Okay.
Continue to speak.
Continue. The Traveling Without Moving, I actually really dig All Right. It's a little simple. It's a romance song, of course. Spend the night together. You know, yeah. All right. It starts off with very kind of quiet. It starts off kind of quiet, nice little ditty, and then kind of moves into that sort of full funk. But it's so catchy. I enjoy that song quite a bit. And you know, actually picking a song off that off of Rock Dust Light Star, I think White Knuckle Ride. Ooh, there is something about it, about that main hook that makes me want to listen to that song again and again and again, and I could listen to it. And it actually kind of feels very representative of the album, to be honest. Rock Dust Light Star, the title track, is the first track in, and it kind of says, you know, here's the album, but then White Knuckle Ride is like, and here's the music that we are going to do. Sort of thing. If that makes any sense, listen to the album, tell me if I'm on crack. All right, on to you, sir.
I'm going to keep this a little more concise. I know that I tend to ramble on with my recommendations, so I'm going to try and keep it a low amount. Off of Traveling Without Moving, there's a bonus track at the end called Function. Function as in like funk, F-U-N-K, then P-I-L-O. I love it. I just like, it makes me want to dance. It's just like... I don't know, there's just something so fun about it. Like, I think there's a guy like with a cowbell going, and I just want to strut my stuff with that song. So it's not an obvious choice, but I dig it. In the Return of the Space Cowboy, Light Years, as I mentioned before, just briefly, it has a two movements in it. Like, there's this verse part, and that's not amazing, but then it gets into this chorus where suddenly like jazzes up, and now I've got that sunshine in my life, and I'm a sucker for it. It makes me go like purr. it hits home for me. Yeah, I think I'm gonna have to go with Canned Heat. It just like
no, Coach can't.
Honestly, can't. Like it just. I mean, on a personal level, it hits it home for me because I have such a nostalgic. It's really nostalgic for me, but also like, it is a great dance song. Not only because they like command that you dance, basically in the song itself, but it's just you move your body to it, and it just pulls you in, and I'm impressed because I'm not actually a huge disco fan. Sorry, Disco Man, if you ever listen to me. But you know, like the fact that they still make disco and it still sounds good, and in fact, better than ever. I think it's impressive. So, yeah, good on Jamiroquai. I think I'll go with those three.
Oh, awesome!
Candy in my heels tonight, baby. Ooh, which Steve used to think was candy in my heels.
It does sound like candy. Yeah. Like, and that doesn't make any less sense. Canned heat, candy. I mean,
you know, canned heat. Like you're dancing
because it's so hot.
It's so hot. You're like, ow! Ooh, you gotta move your feet up.
But yeah, no, that makes sense. But if you have candy in your heels, it's because they're so sweet. You know, and he's dancing and he's feeding the people around him because
like,
it's so sweet.
Like
so
M&Ms are flying
like,
out of his
sugar,
shoes.
Sugar baby, sugar baby.
Nom nom nom. Like there's candy in my heels, guys.
Okay, how does that make any less sense?
Canned heat makes perfect sense.
So does candy. I'm not saying. All right. Anyways. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No.
All right. Well, we're going to close out by saying.
The funky things that people say.
Music A to Z podcast is hosted by Steven and Doug Ferguson and is produced by me, Steven Ferguson. You should check out our other works at nshgfilms.com, DougJCFerguson.com, and StephenGCFerguson.ca.